This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston, and today we'll be taking a trip back to 1984 for the wild and crazy days of the Rock and Wrestling Connection getting underway with WWF Championship Wrestling, June 16th, 1984. And there's so much to get to. There was so much going on in the World Wrestling Federation at that time. But first, a few plugs for my own edification. You can reach me via email, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, GF Allentown Pod is the screen name there. On Facebook, where I'm trying to be a little bit more active, just a little bit more each and every day. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. And follow the show on both my own SoundCloud feed and on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, where there are a lot of other very interesting shows surrounding the G1 US Classic that had just happened about a week and a half ago, and also the ROH History podcast. There's something for everybody there. And don't forget to listen to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed for some of those great pod blasts, which are 10 to 20 minute blurbs on a particular wrestler, kind of making the case and, you know, discussing where they rank in history. There was a very good one recently on Paul Orndorff, another one on Adrian Adonis. I suggest you check all of them out. They don't take very long. I know people are willing to listen to 6-hour podcasts, so you can most certainly take 10 to 20 minutes out of your day to listen to one of those. So back to WWF 1984. There was so much going on in the promotion, as Vince McMahon was on the march, although he did have to, he got a little sidetracked around this time period as his father, Vince Sr., passed away on May 27th. And he had really only discovered that he was sick earlier on in 1984. And really what had happened was he had discovered that the cancer that he had spread all over his body. And when that happens medically, it's really too late, even nowadays, for, you know, the doctors to be of much help, and radiation can only go so far. So he passes away on May 27th. He actually is not on this show. On this taping, it is Mean Gene Okerlund and Lord Alfred Hayes on color commentary. It's very unusual not having Vince there, and especially at one of the points, one of the biggest points in the WWF's history, where you have Cyndi Lauper on Piper's Pit in this episode. But before I get to that, there was so, the WWF had their hands in so many baskets all over North America. So it would probably be a good idea to run down all the stuff that was going on just a by-city basis. Obviously, the Northeast was locked down for them with Boston, New York, Philadelphia. We all know that that's their home base, but obviously they were expanding out into other areas, such as Toronto, Ontario. And the TV was going to be starting up there, starting with the July 7th edition of Maple Leaf Wrestling, where all of a sudden it turned into WWF Maple Leaf Wrestling, as the Tunneys had gotten into bed with Vince McMahon and had deserted Jim Crockett Promotions. And fairness, Jim Crockett had been sending not the best talent up to Toronto earlier in 1984, and it's a debate whether perhaps Jim Crockett knew he was going to lose control of the city of Toronto and Maple Leaf Wrestling to the WWF, so he knew not to send his best guys there, or the fact that Toronto seems like such a weird partner to have for a territory that's based in North Carolina. It just seems like completely disparate areas. And when the WWF entered Canada, they really never looked back from that point, and they established themselves there very quickly. Now, in St. Louis, the WWF had been there since late 83 when they were doing Wrestling at the Chase tapings, and they were not taping at the Chase Hotel anymore by this point in May and June. They actually did a taping on June 15th at the Kiel Auditorium because they were taping TVs for the St. Louis market, much like what they were doing with Canada later on with Maple Leaf Wrestling, as I went over at the beginning of episode 9. St. Louis would kind of get their own deal. You would have Larry Matisick as kind of the face of the television there. Now, down Georgia way, with Georgia Championship Wrestling, they didn't take over the TV until Black Saturday, which would be July 14th. But Vince actually already owned and had closed the deal on Georgia Championship Wrestling by this time. He had purchased the necessary shares from the Briscoes and the various partners that they had. I think Paul Jones was a part of it as well. And of course, the great Jim Barnett, my boy, back in April. And that's according to Sex, Lies, and Headlocks. But they never took over the TBS time slot until July. And the reason why Vince wanted on TBS so badly was because it had become, if not a national network, a near national network. And that would create a second time slot on a national basis because they already had All American Wrestling running on the USA Network. And also around this time, a second show on the USA Network began on Tuesday nights, since they were so happy with the ratings that All American Wrestling was pulling in. We saw the birth of Tuesday Night Titans, a show that was at the very least interesting, and many of the episodes are now on the WWE Network. They finally added all the way up through 1986 when you start to see Gene Okerlund hosting the show. Vince McMahon had hosted for the first 2 years, and then when ratings had started to drop, Vince stepped aside and let Gene be the guy presiding over the funeral. The show ended around the end of 1986, the end of the summer that year. And it was a really kooky show that was set effectively like The Tonight Show. And you had wrestlers coming on and doing personality things. You have an episode very early on with Butcher Vachon singing, which is very strange. And then, of course, later on, you have the Dr. D. David Schultz showing off his gun collection and having a gun go off on him. And then a personal favorite Tuesday Night Titans of mine from May 3rd, 1985, the all-jobber edition of TNT, which featured Johnny Rods, Pete Daugherty, Rusty Brooks, Steve Lombardi, Mario Mancini. What I'm saying is all the greats were on that show, and that's the one that really stands out to me. So they were doing a lot of different TV. By my count, between you had Championship Wrestling, you had All-Star, you had All-American, you had TNT, and then you had the Superstars of Wrestling, which was a C/D show for places that didn't get the other shows. That's 5 hours at least of TV. And Tuesday Night Titans was an hour and a half, 2 hours in the beginning before it became a one-hour show later on. I would be remiss if I do not mention another town that the WWF invaded in the early summer of 1984, And that would be Minneapolis, Minnesota. A rather bold move, as the AWA, despite losing Hulk Hogan and Dr. D. David Schultz and a number of their other guys, Mean Gene Okerlund, who was a bit of a cult figure in the Twin Cities, it was a real shot to go in to Minneapolis and run the Met Center, which is the arena just outside of Minneapolis in Bloomington. It's actually where the Minnesota North Stars played hockey at that time. And they ran a show there on June 17th, so it would have been the day after this episode of Championship Wrestling. And it featured Hulk Hogan's return to Minneapolis. And they played that up, and it was really funny in watching Tuesday Night Titans from early July. They actually showed the main event match from Minneapolis, or Bloomington, between Hulk Hogan and Dr. D. David Schultz. And they were referring to Hulk Hogan returning to the Twin Cities, but of course not referring to the AWA by name, because obviously Vince McMahon was in full F*** you Vern mode at this point, and he was gonna play this up like nobody's business. And that match between Hogan and Schultz is really, really fascinating. It's not like your usual Hogan match that you're used to. You have double juice, and on Tuesday Night Titans, when they go to the match, Hogan is already bleeding, and they put a giant blue square over the screen to the point where you literally cannot see what is going on, and it says edited or censored for television. I put the picture of it on my Twitter about 5 or 6 days before the show's release when I was watching the match, and it's just so weird. And this is a very different Hogan. He's not cartoonish. He is very much an ass kicker. And he had Schultz pinned on a couple of occasions, even hitting the leg drop, and he pulled him up. And he ended up getting the win when Schultz missed his big elbow off the ropes. And then Hogan hit not quite the axe bomber, but with a strong clothesline. So Hogan 84 is certainly a much more, at least to me, watchable wrestler than he would become later on. Although I have, you know, the fond childhood memories of Hogan 87, 88, 89. But as an adult, watching Hogan 84 is much more interesting to me. And he actually makes a brief appearance on Championship Wrestling this week, which I'll get to in a little bit. And he had some irons in the fire as well, as he had a TV pilot cooked up, which ended up being released as a movie in August, and it was called Goldie and the Bears. And like 61% of all 1980s shows, it involved private eyes or private investigators. Now here's the IMDb description for Goldie and the Bears. Following the death of a former football player turned private investigator, his daughter, his former coach, and three of his players take over his PI business. And the three players are former members of the Chicago Bears, and Hulk Hogan is one of them. And the daughter in this case is an actress by the name of Stephanie Farrisee, who would go on to be John Candy's wife in the 1988 movie The Great Outdoors, which I was pining for a couple of weekends ago to be on television, because I turned on Uncle Buck, but it was in the last 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, so I wanted the other John Candy movie that I kind of get the two of them confused because they came out in back-to-back years, and I don't know, they seem a little similar to me. So, There is that. Well, in any event, it wasn't very good, and it didn't get picked up. But can you imagine if Hulk Hogan had gone into acting in 1984? What would the WWF had done then without their meal ticket? They wouldn't have had another obvious option other than, are you going to put the title on a heel Roddy Piper, or are you going to try to turn him babyface, or what are you going to do? It would have really complicated things if Hogan wasn't such a miserable failure as an actor. But they had other things going on too. And the main star of this show, of course, is Cyndi Lauper, and they had built to this Piper's Pit over several weeks, which I'll get into when I get to the segment at the end of the show. But Cyndi Lauper, how does she end up coming in to the WWF? Well, a lot of that had to do with her producer, Man About Town, bit of a gadfly, it seems, David Wolf, who saw an opportunity to get her album promoted. Now, Albano had gotten cast in the Girls Just Want to Have Fun video, which was recorded in the summer of 1983, because he was in first class on a flight from San Juan back to New York. And it's crazy. I wonder how that happened. And he happened to be sitting near Cyndi Lauper, and they struck up a conversation, and it made a real impression on Cyndi. And he was cast as the father in the video, the very beleaguered father. The mother character was actually played by Cyndi Lauper's mother. So there was a lot of cost-cutting in other areas. The video did not cost a lot of money for the time period. And the single was a runaway smash, and the video won Best Music Video at the first MTV Video Music Awards in 1984. So David Wolf saw this connection with wrestling. He had grown up as a wrestling fan in Connecticut and saw an opportunity to perhaps set up a wrestling storyline involving the heel manager, Captain Lou Albano. So he goes in and meets Vince McMahon and thanks him, and this according to the book Sex, Lies, and Headlocks, thanks Vince McMahon for making Albano available for the music video. And then he hit him with an idea that he said will make us a fucking fortune, Vince. I mean it. A fucking fortune. And then he goes in to explain the idea of having a feud between Albano and Lauper. For reasons Wolf never quite figured out, Albano used the pin, which is the safety pin that he put into his cheek, to dangle rubber bands off his cheek like earrings. Wolf knew his girlfriend was no wrestler, but, he told Vince, she'd be a perfect manager and therefore perfect foil to play off against Albano at ringside. Wolf suggested they start small with the two appearing on a WWF show together. Then they could build up to a main event at Madison Square Garden where both stars would come out managing wrestlers who'd fight their grudge match for them. And that's exactly what happened. But there was a build up to this show where Cyndi Lauper would appear. And I'll get to that one, as I said, when we get to the pit segment, which actually closes the show. It's kind of unusual in that Piper's Pit is closing the episode of Championship Wrestling, because it would usually be about two-thirds of the way through, at least in my experience. It would usually be somewhere in like the third quarter, if you're thinking of it as a football game, or if you're thinking of it as a soccer match, about the 65th minute is when Roddy Piper's Piper's Pit would take place. So there's a lot else beyond Cyndi Lauper and Hulk Hogan making an all-too-brief appearance on this show. We actually have a name match involving the Intercontinental Champion, Tito Santana. He is taking on Cowboy Bob Orton, and that is actually the opening match. And later on, we have Jesse the Body Ventura, who unfortunately is in the ring and not on commentary. So we'll have to deal with that the best that we can. Poor Jesse was just never a good worker. And we also have Paul Orndorff in, well, this wasn't actually taped in Allentown the same time as everybody else. This was a replay of a match from All-Star Wrestling a few weeks before. And it is one of the more famous Paul Orndorff squash matches. And we have one of my favorite characters from WWF television in 1984, Dr. D. David Schultz, the man who taught us all about gun safety, facing off against B. Brian Blair, by far my least favorite character from 1984 WWF television. So stick around. I'm certainly going to have some things to say about that match. But let's just dive right into the show, shall we? opening match is a non-title bout between the Intercontinental Champion Tito Santana taking on Cowboy Bob Orton, who is fairly new to the scene again. He had made appearances in the WWF challenging Bob Backlund in 1982 time frame. But first, about Santana, his title reign made a lot of sense, and it also didn't make sense on different levels. And let me explain. Because he had won the Intercontinental title from the Magnificent Morocco in February at the Boston Garden, and it didn't make sense in that you would probably want, if you have a babyface as the world champion for your secondary title, you would probably want a heel in that spot so that you could have heels chasing the world title and babyfaces chasing the Intercontinental title. Instead, you have a situation where you have two babyface champions, so you have all heels. So what is there for the babyfaces to do underneath? Well, it did actually kind of make sense to have two babyface champions because they were much more able to import ready-made heels from other territories, like Dr. D. David Schultz, Paul Orndorff, Orton in this case, Greg Valentine on his way in. And at this time in early 84, this is before the great influx where you would see Junkyard Dog come in and many other guys. But it was a very thin babyface side of the roster in early 1984. Sergeant Slaughter is a babyface, but you don't really want to put him in a title picture because he's so over that he doesn't even need the title. His title is really the American flag. So that's his thing. So you can rule him out. Jimmy Snuka, you're not going to put any sort of title on him because of how unreliable he was. And, well, yeah, there was that other thing. And then you get down to like Ivan Putski, Brian Blair, like, no, you're not going to put titles on them. So you have ready-made heel challengers that can face Santana on their way up to facing Hogan or on their way back after facing Hogan. So I guess it kind of did make sense, at least for the promotion at that time. Personally, I like Santana as the champion. I think he's better as a chaser of the title. And I'm thinking him chasing Valentine in late 84 and into 85 before he captured the title again in the summer, and then his matches against Macho Man Randy Savage in the spring of 1986 after he had coincidentally enough lost the title in February in Boston, the same month and the same place that he had originally won the title for his first reign. And the Santana versus Savage matches are actually being covered right now on the Place to Be podcast. They're going through the MSG shows, and Tito and Macho Man had some great matches at MSG, so I suggest you check out that podcast. I'm looking at Santana in the ring. He's got his jacket that says Santana, and I'm wondering, what happened to that jacket? Like, why did he stop wearing that by, like, 86 and 87, when he just sort of gave up and started wearing T-shirts to the ring? Maybe it was a change in mores of the wrestling business. Was jackets being... clearly jackets weren't being phased out. I mean, you had satin jackets becoming all the rage. But why did... what happened to Tito's jacket that says Santana? Anyway, so you got Bob Orton in there. And as I said, it's a non-title bout, so you're really just kind of establishing everything. And Orton had just come back. He debuted, or re-debuted, in the WWF on the March 27th tapings in Allentown, defeating Lee Wong, another great jobber of the time period. And that actually aired on March 31st. And he wrestled a couple of times on that taping. And he was appearing with Roddy Piper regularly. So he was part of that entourage with Orndorff and not so much Schultz. You wouldn't see him with Schultz as part of that, because Schultz got phased out of the Piper Orndorff triumvirate fairly early on, because I had mentioned in episode 2 that those guys didn't really get along with Schultz. I know that's a real shock to those who know what they know about the old Dr. D. But Orton had been wrestling in Jim Crockett Promotions and was part of the angle with Harley Race and Ric Flair leading up to Starrcade 83 with the trying to collect the bounty alongside Dick Slater to injure Ric Flair. And he had continued into 1984 wrestling in JCP, and it leads to one of those things on wrestling data that really confuses me. Much like Greg Valentine, he had a bit of, I guess, an overlap. I don't want to say it's kind of like getting together with your new girlfriend before you broke up with your ex-girlfriend, but it kind of looks a little bit like it. He's wrestling in two places at once at various times. There's results for Bob Orton all the way up into May when he was firmly established on WWF television. He's being jobbed out. He's losing to Johnny Weaver and Pez Watley and all that. But the thing that blows my mind is there are results for him in different places on the same day. He's losing to Brian Adidas in Raleigh on May 8th, but he's also wrestling three times on the Allentown tapings. So how could he possibly be in two places at once? And then later, you had him wrestling in, I guess, Sumter, South Carolina, losing to Pez Watley. And then he's also losing to Ivan Putski by countout in Freehold, New Jersey. So how does that... I refuse to believe that both of those actually took place. And I'm very glad that we have these results websites. But for the true completists and OCD people like myself, it just causes me, like, how is Bob Orton in two places at the same time? What is he, like Joel Youngblood, that guy who got hits for two major league teams in two different cities in the same day? Like, what is going on here? Anyway, this match is a bit of a treat because it is two above-average workers in a match on WWF television, not something you would see very often. But first, what we have is Hulk Hogan is introduced by Joe McHugh, who sadly did not do the full read-through of the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission and Dr. George Zoharian at the beginning of this card. And Hogan comes out to ringside, shakes hands with the people, gives his headband away to somebody. He's not wearing the bandana at this point because he's still got a good amount of hair up on top. He shakes hands with Tito Santana a couple times, just sort of points at Bob Orton. And Lord Al is blown away by this. He's on color in place of Gene, who is now doing the play-by-play. He's blown away by how nice of a guy Hogan is to come out and shake hands with the dirty people. Well, he didn't say dirty people, but Hogan 84 is a much more likable character. He just comes across that way. And when I see him in that year, it takes me back to a certain time where I forget about all this gawker nonsense. I forget about all the stupid Hogan stuff that would come later. So this match gets underway, and Santana ends up working a wrist lock into an arm bar, but Orton comes back with a fireman's carry takedown. So we're getting some wrestling on a World Wrestling Federation show here. Single leg takedown by Orton. He's kicked off by Santana, which works into a test of strength. And Tito goes to the mat and works a monkey flip and nearly gets a three count on it off Orton. Okerlund says that these two guys are very close in ability. And that was my thought, too, is this is a true meeting of equals. And I think Tito and Bob Orton is a really good match. And I was excited to see it on the bell. I know that Tito is going to keep the title, and you're probably going to have a non-finish, but we'll see where that goes. Orton refuses to break clean on the ropes and gets in a cheap shot. And he's referred to as, I don't know why this struck my ear so weird, the man from Kansas. And he's actually from Kansas City, Kansas, so it does make sense. But it reminded me, there's no better way to piss off somebody who's from Kansas City, Missouri, which is the big city, Kansas City, like your Kansas City Royals, the Kansas City Chiefs. They all play in Kansas City, Missouri. There's no better way to piss off somebody who lives in the Kansas City, Missouri area than by saying that they are from Kansas. I have a friend in Kansas City, and I remember, and I'm not trying to cram in a second Springsteen reference again, but going to a Springsteen show in Kansas City in 2008, and he said, "Good evening, fine citizens of Kansas," and forgetting to say city. And that really pisses off people from Missouri. So if you want to piss off somebody from that area, that's how you do that. Tito fires up with the babyface comeback with some right hands. Sends Orton for the ride, but puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. Then we get Orton with a whip to the corner. Tito reverses it, but on the charge, Orton gets his knee up into Santana's collarbone, and Tito falls out of the ring. And when he gets back up on the apron, it looks like Orton is going to suplex him back into the ring, but he actually only lifts him up halfway and puts him on the top rope to set him up for the superplex. But Tito fights back with some forearms and sends Orton to the mat there. And then Tito sets up for the flying forearm, which Orton bumps all the way to the outside. And somehow Tito, I don't know if it was his own momentum or whatever, he ends up outside as well. And neither one of them recovers in any sort of quick fashion. So we get a double count out here. And this was a fine match for WWF TV. I mean, usually you'd see, you know, your usual boring 3 to 4 minute squash or whatever, unless you had somebody who was dynamic, you know, in terms of interacting with the crowd, like a Paul Orndorff, who would work a little bit more fun squash match than most guys. I would have liked to have seen what Tito and Orton could do with a longer match. I'd seek out stuff on the house show circuit between those two guys. I'd have to look up when these guys might have faced off again, but they did have several matches. I know a lot of the house show stuff is now gone off YouTube, so thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, copyright Nazis, that we won't be able to see any sort of Tito versus Bob Orton match. But like I said, this is perfectly fine fare for WWF television of the time, even though it ended up in a, you know, BS, no contest, double countout.
Short people got no reason. Short people got no reason to live.
Go to the update now, and this is the one Vince appearance on this program. And Mean Gene promises that it'll be, quote, a short one. Ha ha, Okerlund, you got one there. And this update is on what is termed the Mighty Midgets of the WWF. And Vince, I don't know what to comment on here. The weird orange peachish suit. I don't know if it's actually peach, if it's some sort of hidden message about his intentions for Georgia or whatever. But I'm really struck by the way Vince is sitting during this segment. He's sitting straight on facing the camera, and he's doing it in such a way, usually when you see a person at a desk, you can only see them from about where their heart is, where their breastbone is, up. Vince has decided to kind of lean back or whatever and show off his entire upper frame. And this is before the ripped and jacked, roided up Vince that we would see later on. But he's almost like he's trying to make himself big, like he's trying to fight off a bear. I don't understand. Like, this is another one of those Vince McMahon psychology things that I just don't know what the hell he's doing. So he throws it to some clips of the Mighty Midgets, and we really only get highlights of Tiger Jackson here. This is the only person who is mentioned by name, and he hits a kind of a sorry-looking flying head scissors because the announcers have to cover it up with. It's a modified version of, and whenever you hear the term modified version of, it probably just means that the move got screwed up in some way. And Vince says that they are good for more than just a few belly laughs. And I'm always conflicted by the minis, as they're now known. And I'm, for me, I'm glad that they have work and that they're, you know, being paid to do something and are contributing to the business, as it were. I feel bad for laughing because I know that they're trying their best and this and that kind of stuff. But I also think it's part of my own coming up as a wrestling fan, for whatever reason, especially when I was a teenager, you know, during the Attitude Era, I just didn't have the appreciation for the need for comedy as part of the greater show in wrestling. And that was how they would put in comedy in the 70s and 80s. Instead of doing, let's say, backstage skits for TV that are so commonplace and cliched now, they would run out the minis or midgets, as they were known then, and they would have a, you know, 5 or 6 minute match or whatever and get the people chuckling. And it seems to have been completely phased out. I know that they released Hornswoggle a couple of years ago, and they had that Wee LC match between Hornswoggle and El Torito, which was the last really good minis match that the WWE ever put on. So this is about me overcoming my own conflicted emotions.
We'll be following the mighty midget wrestlers in updates to come throughout their careers in the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah, right. You'll be following up with updates on these guys. You're never even going to mention them again, hardly. But you will put them on the WrestleMania 3 card and give us that great moment of King Kong Bundy laying out Little Beaver.
Brand new official World Wrestling Federation magazine is now on sale. Read about Sergeant Slaughter's march into our nation's capital. Find out how Tito Santana made a young boy's dream come true. Read of the Beauty and the Beast, Captain Louis Albano, and rock star Cyndi Lauper. World champion Hulk Hogan visits with Johnny Carson and Brooke Shields, while the Samoans visit with Mr. T. Where's the beef? It's in Montreal. Visit with Andre the Giant, who invites you into his very own restaurant. All this and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine, now on sale at your local newsstand.
And you can pick up the June-July 1984 edition of the WWF magazine off eBay. Somebody has helpfully put it up for auction with a starting price of $99.99 with $3.12 shipping. I don't know how they came up with that. And Andre the Giant's restaurant in Montreal was called Le Pichet, which was a French restaurant on McKay, which is actually near what is now the Centre Bell, home of the Montreal Canadiens. I don't know where the article on Hogan and Brooke Shields and Johnny Carson is from. Hogan appeared on The Tonight Show with Brooke Shields, but that was in 1982, so I don't know if they're pretending like that had happened in the current day, because he was in the AWA when he made his appearance on The Tonight Show, so who knows what they were getting at there. So pick it up. It's only $103, so feel free to spend your money frivolously. Right now we have Jesse the Body Ventura, who had just returned a week earlier. He is taking on Billy Travis. Travis is 23 years old at this time, and he was famous mostly for his work in Memphis, CWA, USWA, later on, all the way up into the 90s. We also share a birthday, me and him, so I can add him to that list that includes Barry Larkin, John Daly, Saddam Hussein, Jay Leno. He can go right in there in that group. And a turning point, no pun intended for him, was his heel turn in 1989 on Chris Adams. And he developed a character that had a lot of the same mannerisms with the guitar shots and all that that you would later see from Jeff Jarrett in the WWF in the mid-90s. But the most famous Billy Travis story was in 1997, and I'm going to take this from OneWrestling.com's account here. He, meaning Travis, also had the distinction in 1997 of being, to the best of my knowledge, the only wrestler legitimately arrested on a live wrestling TV show. Travis allegedly had been delinquent in child support payments, and the police showed up at the WMC studio where the USWA did their live broadcast to arrest him. The promotion, however, managed to talk police into letting them incorporate the arrest into an angle to further the Travis Brian Christopher program. And then it goes on, after the USWA folded in 1997, Travis worked on the independent scene in Tennessee. And it was at the time of that heel turn in 89 that he took on the full name Billy Joe Travis, which, if you ask me, kind of pigeonholes him as a Southern wrestling guy. But I don't think he was ever going to be a player, say, in WWE at any point because of his size. And unfortunately, he passed away in 2002, so I guess it was a moot point. Now, here's Jesse the Body Ventura making his return. After going back to the AWA, Ventura was in the WWF in 1982 for a while. He didn't really tag all that much with Adonis. He's working mostly as a single, feuding with the likes of Tony Atlas. And I've mentioned that cage match that he had against Atlas with the ending that I enjoyed so much, with Ventura taking too much time going out of the cage and then Atlas quickly escaping the cage on the other side before Ventura knew what was happening. So Ventura comes back, plucked from Vern Gagne's AWA, yet another guy. Of course, his talents would help the WWF, not in the ring, but as part of the broadcast team, as he would come down with those blood clots, which would take place in September. He would be hospitalized for that, as Big John Studd stepped in to take his place in the program with Hulk Hogan. And there's something I want to point out about Jesse's outfit here. He always had the outlandish hair and the many earrings, in which he takes his sweet time getting them all out of there before the match can begin. His shirt says something called Plato's Retreat, and I don't know much about that, so I decided to look it up. And Plato's Retreat was a swingers club in Manhattan that was owned by Larry Levinson and later Fred J. Lincoln. The club catered to heterosexual couples and bisexual women. And it opened in 1977 and closed in 1985. And so he's wearing this, I don't know, you would never know what it was unless you knew at the time. There was probably no way to look something like that up. It would probably be something in pornographic magazines of the time that it might advertise in. So it's kind of funny that Jesse is wearing that shirt, and he had worn it the week before on Championship Wrestling as well.
Plato's Retreat. That's interesting.
This is a Jesse match, so you're not going to see a lot of dynamic moves here. So I'm probably going to go with the way I would do the Atom Bomb matches. No, it doesn't mean I'm going to go on a 5-minute dissertation about nuclear power. But I get distracted here right after the match. Well, Jesse is still in his routine of taking all of his crap off. The WLVI logo comes across the bottom of the screen, and that would be the channel that I watched wrestling on as a young lad, Channel 56, one of the independent stations in the Boston area that carried the weekend WWF programming. I think it may have switched over to the Fox affiliate, 25, after a little while. But anyway, 56 had a lot of good programming back in the day. It became a WB affiliate when that whole deal started in 1995. And as is custom during the opening lockup of the match, the announcers kind of go silent. And what they would do is that they would allow the read of what the upcoming event is. So who's coming to the Cumberland County Civic Center, or in this case, promoting the show next Saturday night at the Boston Garden. And it's often forgotten that Howard Finkel is a very talented ring announcer, and he was very good at reading these promos. But sometimes in the beginning, he was just not very good, and this was an example of that.
One individual who certainly has been working his way up the ladder in the World Wrestling Federation is Terry Daniels. Of course, Mr. Slaughter, the Sarge, brought him in as the first member of the Elite Cobra Corps. And thus far, Terry Daniels has certainly been earning his stripes, shall we say, in the World Wrestling Federation. On the 23rd of June, 1 week from tonight in Boston, Terry Daniels will face undoubtedly his toughest competition to date in Samoan number 3.
That took him 30 seconds to go through all that. And it would have taken a normal person maybe 12 or 15. And I suspect that Howard is not entirely at fault there, because that sounds like something that Vince McMahon wrote with like the wordiness and all that. I do like how he said Mr. Slaughter at one point. I've never thought of calling him that. And saying that Samoan number three, or Samula, is his toughest challenge to date. For Christ's sakes, he was on Championship Wrestling last week against the Iron Sheik and basically got his ass kicked until Sergeant Slaughter, or Mr. Slaughter as you call him, came down to the ring and pushed Sheik off the ropes to force a DQ. So are you saying, with a straight face, I have a short-term memory. I remember the Iron Sheik being on last week. You are telling me that Samula is tougher competition than the guy who ended Bob Backlund's 5.5-year title reign and had the World Wrestling Federation Championship for 4 weeks earlier in the same year that we're talking about right here? Sorry, that just kind of pisses me off for whatever reason. Jesse is throwing Travis down as this is going on. And like I said, Adam Bomb rules here. There's not much in terms of a moveset from Jesse the Body. Although when he does, Travis gets him in like an arm wringer and Jesse nails him with a thumb to the eye. And all I can hear is Jesse, the announcer, saying, "Ah, that's a Jesse the Body move right there." And Billy Travis is very good at selling for and bumping for Venturi. He gets thrown to the outside and takes kind of a, I don't want to say a nasty bump, but there was no padding outside the ring in Allentown, but they did have these blue containment things to separate the fans, which was actually a relatively new phenomenon in Allentown. Of course, they would only have one more taping after this. Meanwhile, in the ring, Jesse is giving Travis a chance to sell on the outside as he's arguing with Dick Worley, and that also reminds me of Jesse the announcer and how he would always express disdain thinking that Dick Worley is the worst referee of them all. And Worley, admittedly, is horrible. Dick Worley is like this alternate universe version of, because he kind of looks like him, of Coach from the first three seasons of Cheers. And he kind of looks like him. It's like he's the worst possible thing that Coach from Cheers could have become, this lousy wrestling referee. In any event, Jesse brings him back in finally and gets him in the reverse body vice for the finish. And I always thought it was called the Argentine backbreaker. At least that's what I thought it was called. I know Bruno used that as a finisher on occasion, and Rick Rude used it as a finisher early in his run before he adopted the Rude Awakening. Around the time of WrestleMania 4 is when he busted out that move. Of course, Jesse and Rick Rude, very closely connected, as Jesse was always an advocate on commentary for Ravishing Rick. So another win for Jesse to build him up slowly. But, you know, it's a shame that he had those health problems, which, you know, he blames his time in Vietnam for, you know, with exposure to Agent Orange and all that. But in reality, and it's going to sound weird, it was probably the best thing that could have happened to him, because a singles program with Hulk Hogan, while he might have made some money on it, I don't think it's something they would have gone with long term, because the matches would have been really, really bad. And he had a program with Bob Backlund back in 1982, and they got one MSG match. So in the Vince Sr. days, they were not looking at Jesse as a viable single star. He's really much more of a tag guy. And after he had the blood clot issue, he would be in more tags. He had the Saturday Night Main Event tag with Piper and Orton against the Hillbillies, Hillbilly Jim, Uncle Elmer, and whichever one it was, Cousin Luke, Cousin Junior. I always get it confused which one was which at the time. So Jesse Ventura in his very early days here, and at the end of the match, they give us the address in which you can write in your feedback to the WWF. So you can send it to P.O. Box 1538, Greenwich, Connecticut, zip code 06836. I wonder who has that P.O. Box right now.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of The Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I am not what you would call a straight-up heel fan. I'm not going to cheer for all the heels. I'm going to cheer for whoever. I'm going to cheer for whoever strikes me as somebody that I like. But in this case, this is one of those matches, which is Dr. D. David Schultz versus Brian Blair, where I am going to be firmly on the heel side of the ledger. And it's not because Dr. D kind of scares the hell out of me, even though I'm a grown man. It's just the psychotic look that's in his eyes sometimes that just, I don't know. I'm afraid if I say anything bad about him, not that I would say anything bad about him because I love the guy's entire act. And when I look at him, if you get rid of the blonde curly hair there and you shave him bald, which really didn't come into fashion until maybe a decade later, he just kind of looks like a bigger Steve Austin. He's 6'6", 270, and I just love the look, and he's just an incredible badass that, for whatever reason, I'm just really taken by this guy. Of course, he had the run-in with John Stossel at Madison Square Garden backstage, which was in December of 84. It was just after Christmas. It was the same show as Roddy Piper hitting Lou Albano over the head with the gold record and all hell breaking loose there. And that 2020 special on wrestling did not air until February 21st of 85. And that was around the time when Schultz made his last on-screen appearance, although the infamous gun thing on Tuesday Night Titans, the date on that on the network is in early March, which was several weeks after Schultz would have last been on WWF TV. So I don't understand. So kind of the time on it seems a little strange. So he hits Stossel at the end of December. We go into 85, and it almost looks like Schultz is being punished for it because he didn't get fired for messing around with John Stossel. I'll get to why he was fired in a second, but he's jobbing to the likes of Tony Atlas and George Wells. The fact that David Schultz lost to George Wells on February 6th, according to historyofwwe.com, just that strikes me as a severe punishment. And it just makes me wonder what his 1985 would have looked like. Would it have been like Triple H in 1996 after the whole curtain call business? It really would have been, I think, a waste of his talents because he was an effective heel all through 1984. And I just love the fact that the guy became an actual bounty hunter and a damn good one. At least, I don't know if there's statistics on this, but if you catch 1,500 fugitives, I feel like that's a lot. There's no bountyhunterreference.com for me to go to compare him with other guys in the field, but it seems like he did a pretty good job there. And his last match was on February 10th against JYD in San Diego. And the next night in Los Angeles was when he had the infamous run-in with Mr. T backstage or out in the crowd or whatever. It was not a televised thing from the Los Angeles Sports Arena, and it was at that time that he was fired. And he did work in Memphis for a little bit, but he did not wrestle at all after around 1987 or so. And I feel like it's kind of a loss for the business, but, you know, if he was going to become a good bounty hunter, hey, you know, what the hell. On the other hand here, we have B. Brian Blair, the store brand white toast of the World Wrestling Federation, and the juvenile guy in me kind of wants to post a video clip of Brian Blair being smacked around, but with like a picture, like the logo of Wonder Bread superimposed over his face. That sounds like a highly original idea and not something, like I said, completely juvenile or anything like that. Gene Okerlund on play-by-play here, he at the beginning of the match, he just decides to out-and-out steal one of my favorite Gorilla Monsoon-ism.
Now this, ladies and gentlemen, could be a main event in any arena.
Main event in any arena in the country, Jess. You know, one of my favorite things to do is to take weird screen caps like a match from the LA Sports Arena. The graphic is Blue Blazer versus Barry Horowitz, and send it to my friend Keith via DM on Twitter and just put in as the quote, main event in any arena in the country, Jess. That's one of the things that I like to do. So, but imagine if you will, okay? Because then Okerlund goes to name various arenas, the Olympic Auditorium in LA and the Madison Square Garden in New York. Can you imagine Brian Blair main eventing Madison Square Garden? They would probably draw like 4,000. It would be like the lowest crowd in the history of MSG. And look, I don't like Brian Blair. I'm not trying to make this a shticky sort of thing. I'm really not too much into general shtick on this show, or at least I don't think that I am anyway. But I just don't like the guy. He's so boring, and he kind of drags down Schultz in this match, I think, a little bit. You get some mat work early, and whatever, it's fine. I'm like, okay, something good's going to happen here because Schultz is going to get in some offense or whatever. We get a head scissors by Blair, and Schultz actually reaches out with his leg to get the rope. So he puts his leg on the rope, and the referee, for some reason, kicks his leg. This would be Alberto Roman, who is our official here, kicks Schultz's leg off the rope, but then orders the break anyway. I don't know what was going on, if he was, I don't know. Alberto Roman is not exactly regarded highly as one of the better officials of the time frame. Schultz offers a handshake, and that's not going to go anywhere. We get a side headlock by Blair. And instead of doing the back suplex as a counter, which you'll often see in the side headlock, he lifts up Blair in the same kind of fashion and drops him on his knee for a backbreaker. And that was a really cool move. And then you get a conventional backbreaker. And he picks up Blair for that, and he gets a two count because B. Brian gets a foot on the rope. We get a Blair comeback, a right hand to the gut, a knee lift. You know, nothing too spectacular. He hits him with an elbow smash off the corner turnbuckle on the top of the head. And then we get a reversal of an Irish whip. And Schultz looks to get a right hand in, but it's blocked. Blair gets a right hand of his own. And Schultz decides that he's had enough of this crap, goes for a single leg takedown, and just kind of holds on to him and grabs the rope with his other hand and picks up the win while having his hand on the rope. Think the Honky Tonk Man over Ricky Steamboat finish where he won the Intercontinental title, which was a little bit botched, I guess, at that time, where Honky grabbed the top rope for leverage. That is what Schultz was doing here. And it struck me, for whatever reason, that Schultz was just really sick of this match and just wanted to go home, because this is about 4 minutes and 30 seconds, somewhere in that ballpark. And Blair is very upset in the ring and making his appeal to the referee. And, of course, nobody cares because it's Brian Blair. But my point to him would have been, hey, dude, yeah, sure, you couldn't kick out or whatever, but you were near the ropes. You could have reached back with your arm and grabbed the rope, in which case the official, if he had seen it, would have stopped counting. So I don't want to hear your whining and crying, Brian Blair, okay? Just, please, just go to the, whatever. Just wait for Brunzel to get here, and then maybe you'll have some life in your act. Mea culpa from me here, as earlier I had said that Vince McMahon was only going to be in the first update segment, but I forgot. There's another update segment here, and he's going to be making even one more appearance in a pre-taped match later. And here we have an update segment on Hulk Hogan and his recent goings-on at the NATP convention, which is the National Association of Television Program Executives. And the idea of what Hogan was doing there is, in 1984, a wrestling company would show up to the NATP convention in order to hawk their syndicated shows to the various stations. And Hulk Hogan, of course, would have been the biggest possible name you could have sent to one of these things. So it was a real ace in the hole for Vince to send him. And they show him grabbing some guy playfully, who I guess was like the TV programming director in Cincinnati or some such business. So not really a whole lot here. Again, they show the Hulk Hogan and Brooke Shields thing, which is clearly from 1982. And you could tell because of Hogan's hairline. It's another one of those things where you can mark time by the top of Hogan's head. And by the way, nobody has started a podcast called The Top of Hogan's Head yet, so I'm leaving that out there, along with my idea for a USWA-only show that is called Walking in Memphis. Just, you know, make sure you give me a producer credit on that. That's all I really care about. So Vince promises more updates to come on Hulk Hogan, and he would certainly deliver on that. Certainly a lot more than the updates on Tiger Jackson that he was promising. We also get Gene Okerlund, and oddly enough, he is in Piper's Pit. And it's kind of strange because he's just saying that Cyndi Lauper is coming. Don't worry, she will be here. I spoke to Roddy Piper, and Cyndi Lauper will be in the pit. And this was something that had been teased for, you know, a number of weeks, so when we get to that segment, I'll go into the backstory on that more. But now we have a pre-tape match, and this one was done in Hamburg, Pennsylvania, and it aired on All Star Wrestling on May 26th. And we have Vince on commentary again here with Okerlund, and it is Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, who is very, very chatty with the crowd again, and he is facing off against Rudy Diamond, who might be known as the black guy jobber who happened to be from Boston. So that's one of those things. And I look him up and to see if there's anything local on him around here. And there was a contractor named Rudy Diamond who was in a lawsuit about a decade ago. But I'm pretty sure that it's not him. I don't think it's the same Rudy Diamond. Although anything is possible, I guess. mean, who knows? Well, right now, Orndorff, it's very, very heavy into the crowd chanting Paula at him. And this is one of those things where the crowd chanting certain things at guys and getting them to react was a big thing, like the Wimp with Iron Mike Sharp, and a year earlier in his heel days, Sergeant Slaughter with Gomer, although that had dated back to 1981. And the way Orndorff would sell the Paula chant was, picture the most mad you would be about anything in your own life and multiply it times five. That's how off the handle Orndorff is here. And of course, Orndorff was a little bit off kilter as it was anyway. But oh, chant at him, and you know, oh God, he goes out of his mind. I should throw in this little note about Rudy Diamond, because there's really not, this is pretty much the highlight of his career. Although he was in the 1986 King of the Ring at Sullivan Stadium in Foxborough. That would be the second King of the Ring, where he lost to Pedro Morales in the first round. And you're probably wondering, why the hell was Rudy Diamond in the King of the Ring tournament? Well, he was subbing for Bob Orton on that night. So, and Rudy, he's a little tired, I guess, of the stalling or whatever. So he actually leaves the ring as Orndorff is mouthing off to the fans, and he heads to the back. And referee Danny Davis doesn't start counting him or anything. It seems to be a little confusion as to where he is going. And he leaves, comes back with a shirt that says Paula on the front and Paula on the back. It was one of those kind of t-shirts you could get in the mid-1980s. In any mall, it seemed like there was a t-shirt place where they would do like little iron-on letters or whatever. So he had on a black t-shirt that just said Paula in white letters. And this incensed Paul Orndorff, which was probably a bad idea for Rudy Diamond, given that he is a black man. You have Paul Orndorff, who has a history of promos that are not exactly racially sensitive, shall we say. And so this was just a really, really bad idea by him. And Orndorff just tears him apart. And that's what makes this a memorable squash. You get a belly-to-back suplex, which would have looked at home in All Japan Pro Wrestling, because he dumps him right on his head. We get a clothesline that looks about 1.7 times more stiff than the usual Orndorff clothesline. And then he hits the pile driver. And then, instead of going for the pin after the first pile driver, he decides to tear the shirt off Rudy Diamond and just kind of throws that aside. And for good measure, hits a second pile driver. And Rudy Diamond, he's just convulsing on the mat. And he gets the pin for the 1-2-3. And I love when he gets up from the pin, he gives him a boot rake just for good measure. A nice little heel move there. So you're probably wondering, why would you even bother with something like this, considering that Orndorff was already plenty over as a heel some 6 to 7 months after his arrival in the WWF? My response to that is just simply, why not? It gets the chant over, so now when Orndorff is at the house shows and people seeing the way he would react, which was, just like I said, Mike Sharp with the Wimp thing, but multiplied by, you know, an incredible amount, why not do something like this? It gives a little bit of personality, I guess, to Rudy Diamond. Not that he ever went anywhere with it, but it gave something memorable in his career. You have Orndorff just being a complete ass kicker on television, and you've given direction to your fan base of yell this chant of Paula at this guy, and he's going to fly off the handle, and you're going to see magic happen. And then after the match, we get a promo from Orndorff, which is oddly in the Piper's Pit set. I don't know why Okerlund is hanging out in the Piper's Pit area. And Orndorff is screaming about the chant, and he's just not very happy. I love when Okerlund tells him to watch his language. Maybe Orndorff was getting a little close to crossing that line. 1984, certain language, there was a little bit more, less tolerance for bad language on television than there would be, say, a decade and a half later. This interview ran, I think, a little bit long, at least for my taste. It almost seemed like they had time to fill, A lot of this stuff seems like time failure. You're taking a match from Hamburg from a couple weeks before. You have a second update segment. You have Okerlund hanging out in Piper's Pit for a minute telling us that, believe us this time, Cyndi Lauper is going to be here and all that. And for good measure now, we have a promo from Roddy Piper, and they're now kind of doing that in front of the ring in the empty arena promos that they would do. And Piper is in his Rowdy Panther shirt, the one you would see him wear to the ring at WrestleMania 1, and also a shirt that I purchased off ProWrestlingTees.com shortly after Piper passed away in 2015. I just feel like that was a really cool-looking shirt. And Piper's going to be facing off against Rocky Johnson. And the magic of Roddy Piper in 1984 is not that his act was so great. It's that he was feuding with everybody. And it wasn't in that Dusty Rhodes 1987-88 sort of way where Dusty is booking and making sure to put himself against every heel in the promotion. This was, he would just have these little things that would come up along the line, and Piper would have these feuds with Snuka. He would have this feud with Rocky Johnson. They did face off in the Boston Garden on June 23rd with Piper prevailing. And this feud had started in Piper's Pit, where Piper said that Rocky Johnson should be shining shoes for a living, which is an extremely offensive thing to say. And Johnson gets up and he just slaps him right away, and immediately you get the baby faces from the back to kind of hold him back. You get Brian Blair in the light blue tights. You get Sal Bellomo, who I usually don't have much to say about, but he is wearing a sweet satin jacket that just says Italy in cursive writing on the back. If it wasn't green, I don't know, I would kind of like that. That was a really nice jacket there. And Piper apparently landed in a sucker punch on Johnson as Johnson was being held back by Bellomo and Blair. And Piper, I'm just going to play the Piper promo because it's a Roddy Piper promo, damn it.
Roddy Piper, did I detect a sucker punch from you when a couple of people were holding Rocky Johnson?
Marcus of Queensberry is dead. What did you think you were getting into, huh? I was absolutely right. You should be shining shoes, man. I ain't afraid to say I'm a man. I ain't no woman like you walking around. I'm a man. I ain't afraid to say what I know. There's people out there now, they think, oh, Roddy Piper's cool. Yeah, you tell them Rocky Johnson would kill you. Rocky Johnson would eliminate the normal orangutan around here, Jack, but I ain't normal. There ain't nothing normal about me. You want to go out and get it? Let me tell you something, brother. They say I'm crazy. Rocky Johnson comes out here and says he's crazy. He's an excellent judge of character.
It almost seems like Rocky Johnson was kind of a backup option in case Jimmy Snuka flaked out for any of the obvious reasons, because that feud was kind of put on hold when they had recorded the Piper's Pit segment months before, but they'd only aired it a week before this show. So it almost seems like Snuka was put on the back burner for all those reasons, but they had Rocky Johnson to go to just in case. But of course, the Snuka feud would happen. And about a month later, there's an interesting match that used to be on YouTube, but sadly isn't there anymore, from the Kiel Auditorium, which was a Fijian strap match, which I don't understand what makes it Fijian other than there's a guy from Fiji in it. And Piper gets pinned with a flying body press. And I'm hard-pressed to really name another pinfall loss that Roddy Piper took as a heel in the WWF. Obviously, he got pinned as a babyface on many occasions. Bret Hart, there was the Mr. Perfect one, and then Ric Flair all through late 1991.
The second hand unwind. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you. I'll be waiting. Time after time.
And now it's time for Piper's Pit with guest Cyndi Lauper. Before I get into the segment, though, there was a lengthy build up to this point, so I'm just going to quickly run through the various segments in which Lou Albano and Roddy Piper had advanced this along. It started on the April 28th episode of Championship Wrestling, where Albano was the guest and said that he was responsible for Cyndi Lauper's success. Go to May 12th, And again, he reiterates the point with kind of using media, newspapers, and whatnot, where, and he also says that he can produce Cyndi Lauper on an upcoming Piper's Pit, and Roddy is ecstatic at that development. On May 19th, the following week, a letter is read from David Wolf threatening legal action if Albano continues to claim to be Cyndi Lauper's manager, and they just kind of ignore it, and they say that Cyndi Lauper will be on the pit the following week. We go to May 26th, and Piper comes out looking like a punk rock star with his hair all spiked and whatever, and I think he's got like an earring in or something like that. And one of the things I love through this is that he keeps calling Lou Albano Lou Albino, which I don't... one of those weird mispronunciations that just kind of whatever. And Albano comes out, but there's no Cyndi Lauper. And Albano struggles to try and explain, oh, well, the airplane is late and she got detained and, she will be here, but she's running a little bit late. Now, as for the reality of where Lauper was, she had been touring briefly in Europe in May with her last show of the Fun Tour, at least in the European leg, coming on May 24th in London, so 5 days before this taping. And in the book, Sex, Lies, and Headlocks, apparently what had happened was they were on Cape Cod or Nantucket or whatever, and they drove down from there in a rainstorm to Allentown and managed to get there in time for the 29th. So we go 1 week ahead. We have David Wolf is on the pit, and he says flat out that Lou Albano is a liar. And I kind of like this line for whatever. David Wolf kind of strikes me as an annoying figure, but I do like the line that Lou Albano is often constipated and never imitated. But hey, constipation issues are no joke, I can only assume. We go ahead another week, and we have Albano, and this was actually June 9th. They had two different Piper's Pit segments on in most of the markets because they did replay the snooka coconut angle, but we also had Lou Albano in the pit again, where he gave Roddy Piper an award for being a great bagpiper, and that Cyndi Lauper will be on next week. Roddy Piper has promised this to the audience, so I'm presuming maybe the fans were starting to feel a little bit burned at this point, so they had to drive the point home. They also keep calling Dave Wolf Dave Dog, which I feel like, not your best, Lou, not your best. So we get to this segment here, and one of the first things that I notice is there's a list of all the Piper's Pits from 84 on a YouTube channel that you can easily look up. And this one is about two times longer than your usual Piper's Pit. The pits would only be like a minute and a half to 2.5 minute segment, and this one runs nearly 5 minutes. So it's obviously it's a really big freaking deal, but is very different also in that way. Piper has like the time after time puns. We tried to get her on time after time, and of course that was the single that was out at the time. I played it right before this segment here. Now I'm gonna play the entire interview segment of this, but I kind of want to give some commentary before I do play some of it. Piper is treating her with really kind of kid gloves here. It's kind of unusual, and Piper would just sort of rip into everybody just as a complete loose cannon, for lack of a better term, and he almost seems a little bit starstruck. And it is strange to have the number one musical artist in the country at the time in this dingy agricultural hall in Allentown, which, as Dave Wolf recounted, smelled faintly of livestock. And what happened there, they kind of have a friendly conversation to start talking about the things that they have in common. We are the best at what we do. And Piper saying, oh, she looks lovely, and who does your hair? And, you know, very friendly conversation, not something you would expect from 1984 Roddy Piper.
First of all, I would like to say to you, you look wonderful, Cindy. Well, it's been a long time coming for us to try to get you here. Cindy has flown 7,000 miles to come here and see us. And one thing that I admire about you is we both have something in common. We are both number one at what we do, and you, time after time, and the records that you have out, the girls just want to have fun with all your...
They do.
Hey, they just girls just want to have fun. Where have you been? What have you been doing?
Oh, well, I'm glad to come back. I've been in Europe. It's nice to see all the wrestling fans and the WWE, too. And you, Rodney, how are you? It's great. I've been in Europe. I've been in London.
You've been in London, England. What?
London, England, same thing.
London, England, same thing. Tell me, who does your hair?
Me and Patrick, we do it.
Who's Patrick?
Oh, he's in the back somewhere. He helps me out. Pat.
You look terrific. You look terrific. You know, as we were saying, we're both number one in what we do. And I'm a self-made man, and I realize that through the time, you've had a lot of friends help you out, and especially one Captain Lou Albino, your manager, the man who has taken care of you and actually brought you from nothing and taken you up.
Roddy, wait.
Yes, darling.
No, I love Lou, but he's not my manager. A lot of people think that.
Wait a second. You're not calling. Wait. No, I know you don't mean that. You're not calling Lou Albino a liar. I know that. He's your manager.
Lou would never say that.
And that's where this starts to turn a little bit, in that Cindy thinks that Lou is just screwing around, that it's just Captain Lou being Captain Lou. And then we get Lou Albano. He comes on the scene there, and he starts in with his shtick there that, oh, tell everybody how I took you from nothing. And he's kind of building up a little bit. And then he just kind of goes to the jugular with the women belong in the kitchen sort of stuff. And he starts getting really particularly hostile. And Cindy, who was actually, I guess, battling a cold at the time of this taping, is just kind of sitting there and taking it and is trying to make sense of what Captain Lou is ranting and raving about.
Cindy, sweetheart, how you been, baby? How you doing? Cindy, tell all these people out here how I took you, Cindy, and found you in New York City and Queens, and how I made you a superstar. Tell them what I did for you, Cindy.
Lou, come on. Only kidding. No.
No, wait. No.
Wait a minute. Cindy, tell them how.
You told me.
I wrote the words for time after time, Cindy.
I'm actually rather amused by how Captain Lou takes credit for writing Time After Time, which was actually written by Cyndi Lauper herself, alongside Rob Hyman, who's probably best known for being a member of the Hooters. Anyway, back to the segment.
He's only kidding.
Now, wait a second. Now, you've told me that you've taken 75%. You told me that you brought her from nothing.
Telling how women, Cindy, belong in a kitchen and pregnant, Cindy, that no woman's ever accomplished anything without a man behind her. Cindy, tell him that.
Wait, Lou, you know, I don't like that. You're only fooling around, right? Because I don't like that stuff.
No, wait a second. This is not fooling around.
You're not kidding?
Cindy, just shut up for a minute, Cindy. Tell them what I did for you, Cindy. Tell them how you...
It does seem like they're kind of beating us over the head with the whole women in the kitchen and that sort of thing. But you have to keep things simple sometimes in pro wrestling. As I've said in previous shows, subtlety is something that professional wrestling has never done particularly well. And Cindy, you know, was obviously maybe not a feminist icon of the time, but, you know, her first big hit was Girls Just Want to Have Fun. It was the embodiment of girl power. So she kind of used this in this wrestling angle in real life to, in some way, distance herself from Madonna, who... There's kind of a rivalry there. They both came up through, you know, MTV in that 1984 time period, and it kind of positioned herself as the feminist icon of the music world. And, of course, Madonna would go on and do other things like that later on, but this is kind of Cindy kind of differentiating herself from the other act of the time. And Lou continues to lay it on pretty thick.
Hold it up. Tell him how you came off my reputation, Cindy. Captain Lou Albano, how all women are nothing, Cindy. They're slime. How it takes a man to make a woman.
One second now. Just calm down.
Wait a I saw the video myself, and I know what he's done.
Yeah, about 1 second in the video, but he's crazy.
No, it was a big segment, Cindy. You wrote all for me, Cindy.
Wait a second. I saw the video myself. You can't come out here and tell me that this man is a liar.
I'm not calling him a liar. I don't want to get mad. Now, don't get me mad.
Wait a second. We don't care who gets mad. I'll tell you something. Just wait a second, young lady. I don't care what you think.
Just a minute, Cindy. I want you to be honest. Tell him how I took you abroad, hanging around New York.
What? Abroad?
Go ahead, tell him a barroom broad made you, Cindy. Go ahead, Cindy. Tell him the truth, Cindy.
So the anger in Cindy is building, and it's the broad remark there that really sets her off. What? That's her accent really coming out on that one. So she flips over the little table that's there, and she decides to just start swinging with her purse and hits Lou in the head several times with it, which actually apparently left a couple of welts on Albano, because there was some heavy perfume in there and kind of weighted it down or whatever, or maybe one fell out and hit him in the head. And she's laying in like crazy, and we get David Wolf come out to try to pick her up and carry her away. And now the whole thing is on. And the next week, and here's how they would follow up with this, because we get the closing credits as Wolf and Lauper are at the curtain kind of yelling back at Piper and Captain Lou. The following week, Piper would go and interview Cindy Lauper at a recording studio, and this is how they would end up setting up the brawl to end it all on July 23rd. And of course, the original idea that David Wolf had was to not have Cindy in the ring, given her diminutive stature. It was to use proxies. So Captain Lou would choose a female wrestler, and Cindy Lauper would choose a female wrestler. And of course, it would make a lot of sense for Captain Lou to choose the Fabulous Moolah, as he did, as she was the most famous heel wrestler that they had, their champion for a very long time. Not 28 years, like they say, but she had been their champion for quite a while. But on the babyface side, there wasn't really a whole lot to go on. You could choose Princess Victoria, Velvet McIntyre. These are not particularly dynamic choices to be a babyface, but those were the existing babyfaces. So what they did was they took Cowgirl Wendi Richter, who had so recently been a heel on AWA television. There's a match of hers that's on the April 21st, 1984 edition of AWA All-Star Wrestling. And she wrestled as recently to that in early May at an AWA card in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And in the WWF, she appeared in a tag match on the May 5th episode of Championship Wrestling as a heel, as Cowgirl Wendi Richter. But that is who they would just kind of, that's how they would turn her, is she would be the choice for Wendi Richter, and then for Cindy Lauper. So it would be Wendi Richter versus Fabulous Moolah at the Brawl to End It All, which would air on MTV. So work them in. And she would win the title. But it's really just kind of strange how she was just sort of plucked to do this, probably for a lack of options. And after you had the Piper interview of Lauper in the studio, you had kind of workout videos. Captain Lou was with Fabulous Moolah, and they were working out. You had Cindy Lauper and Wendi Richter to kind of build that up. And then you have the match on July 23rd, and Wendi Richter becomes one of the biggest stars just completely out of nowhere for about the next year or so. Although I do think a lot of her popularity, and it did get her into the Hall of Fame eventually, was due to the fact that Cindy Lauper was there, and just how unusual it was to have a celebrity, like a legit huge star, to be part of wrestling, not week in, week out, but she was making regular appearances. You had the aforementioned MSG show at the end of the year, which was used to turn Captain Lou Albano into a babyface when Piper hit him over the head with the gold record. So there it is. You got Cyndi Lauper on Piper's Pit, and the rock and wrestling connection is off and running. So without any further ado, it's time for another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, this video has been up for quite a while now, so there are more than a few comments, a lot more populated than what we've had the last few weeks. We get Dynamo805. Hulk has a new belt. And yeah, I neglected to point that out when Hogan came strolling out earlier. He has the Hogan 85 belt, which is smaller than that big green thing that he had when he won the title from the Iron Sheik, but this would have to be one of the first appearances of this title on television. ELC1960 says, regarding that clip of Tiger Jackson, he was one of the dinks that followed Doink the Clown around. I believe he was also the son of the legendary midget wrestler Little Beaver, the midget that King Kong Bundy squashed at WrestleMania 3. Jesse Ventura's opponent, Billy Travis, has been deceased for a few years now. So yes, I did not know that about Tiger Jackson, but, you know, there's not a whole lot on midget wrestling that's out there, or at least maybe I just haven't sought it out or whatever. Lava1964 says, I used to tune in every Saturday in hopes of seeing just one devastating pile driver from Mr. Wonderful. Seeing two was a real treat. Yep, laying him in there to Rudy Diamond. And Flipper85 has something to say about Rudy Diamond's attire. Jesus, would you walk around in one of those dirty old arenas in your bare feet? How much dried up vomit, piss, and beer did Rudy Diamond step in that day? And yeah, he was taking a real risk walking around barefoot around Agricultural Hall. I mean, as I said, you know, it did smell faintly of farm animals and whatever. You know, if you have a cut on the bottom of your foot, God knows what is going to happen. And finally, Paul Kersey says, I love the midgets. Those little bastards amuse me. Whatever. Funny how there were, like, no comments there about Cyndi Lauper or anything to do with that other than, you know, how it kind of launched things going forward. Like, nothing on that segment. People were really attached to the Orndorff-Rudy Diamond thing and the midget update. So, that does it for this edition of YouTube Comment Theater.
You can't just walk in on this guy. He did me a personal favor.
All right, Leo.
This man was nice enough to see you. He did me a personal favor.
That's the second time you said personal favor. Why do you keep saying that?
Well, Morty, I'm going to ask a personal favor of the listeners, and it's not going to cost anybody a dime to do any of these things. If you're shopping on Amazon, go to placetobenation.com/Amazon. That'll take you into Amazon.com, but what it'll do is it'll kick back a portion of your purchase to help with the costs of maintaining the Place to Be Nation. Also, leave a 5-star review for many of the podcasts, like Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop, the Pro Wrestling Only Feed, where this show is residing. Leave a 5-star review for friends of the show, Our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast, which is on the Place to Be Wrestling feed as well. They, like I do, they have their own separate feed for now as well. So leave them a 5-star review. That's your homework assignment before next week's show. And next week's show will be taking a look at WCW during a very interesting era in their history. We're going to go to May 14th, 1994, episode of WCW Worldwide, and 'twas the night before Hogan, and all through the house, all the creatures were stirring. And I don't know what I was going to rhyme with there, but Hogan's about to show up, and WCW is a very fun place for the hardcore wrestling fan. And next week's show on that particular Worldwide, we have Ric Flair and Lord Steven Regal in their really, really fun Marquise of Queensbury rules tournament that they had going on at the time. This would be match number 3 in that series. We're also going to see Sting versus Rick Rude in what actually was Rick Rude's last televised match. And it has one of the more WCW endings you'll ever see. You got Dusty Rhodes going crazy on commentary and kind of hosting the show a bit. And much, much more. There's some dude who kicks off the show who's named Terra Rising. I don't know. I don't know whatever became of him. I'll be sure to research that and let you know if he amounted to anything. But thank you so much for listening to this week's show. You have your homework assignment before next week. And tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.